Growing up, there was this kind of wild story kicking around the playgrounds in North Dakota
Oh, yeah.
that if North Dakota, of all places, decided to secede, it'd be like the third most powerful country on earth
Right.
instantly.
Huh. That's quite a claim for a kid's playground.
Right. It just sounded, completely unbelievable. But what we didn't get then was that, wow, there was this real but sort of hidden power sitting right there.
And that playground story, it actually hints at something pretty significant, doesn't it? It really ties back to the Cold War, and these things called intercontinental ballistic missiles, ICBMs.
ICBMs, right?
For anyone listening who might not be familiar, think of an ICBM as basically a huge rocket designed to send a warhead a very long way across continents.
Exactly. And that's really what we're diving into today. We're looking into the world of these ICBMs, but maybe more importantly, the people responsible for them. And we're drawing a lot from the experiences of Major General Robert Parker. He used to head the 20th Air Force, knows a ton about Soviet military stuff, missiles.
A real expert perspective.
And it feels a bit like that deep dive we did back in episode 30, looking at how these big strategic things play out on a more human level
Right,
almost.
exactly. Because this isn't just about the hardware, the missiles themselves. It's about understanding the sheer weight of nuclear deterrence during that whole Cold War
The
period.
human side of it at all.
The human side, yeah. And why it still matters today, really. We want to unpack some of the maybe surprising bits without getting totally lost in the technical weeds.
Okay, so let's start there. General Parker, he actually grew up in North Dakota during the Cold War, so this wasn't abstract for him.
No, not at all. He talks about this constant sort of background fear.
Like the duck and cover drills?
Yeah, those drills in school, people actually building fallout shelters in their yards, stockpiling food and water. It was just there all the time.
Wow, and then he gets drafted.
Right. He gets drafted, ends up in the Air Force, and eventually finds himself stationed right back there at Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota.
Talk about full circle from worrying about it as a kid to being part of the system.
It really brings it home, doesn't it? How these huge geopolitical tensions impacted everyday lives. Reminds me again of some of those themes from episode 30, the local effects of global strategy.
Absolutely. And during that time, the Cold War context, it was almost simpler in a scary way. One big adversary.
Yeah, the focus was intense. Everything, international relations, military planning, it was all seen through the lens of the US versus the Soviet Union.
Which led to this, I guess, controversial idea that the Cold War actually created a kind of stability. Parker touches on that.
He does, and he sort of agrees to an extent. It comes down to that concept of mutual assured destruction.
Right. The idea that launching an attack means you'll be completely wiped out in return.
Exactly. Chilling. But for a while, arguably, it worked. Neither side wanted to push the button because the consequences were just too absolute. But it meant living on a knife edge always.
And Parker actually saw the other side too, right? He went to Russia for arms control inspections.
Yeah, which must have been fascinating. He talks about meeting his Soviet counterparts, young officers just like him, and finding that despite being on opposite sides of this massive nuclear standoff, they basically wanted the same thing, a safer world for their kids, that shared humanity, even then.
It shows the importance of those verification efforts, those treaties, which brings us to the on-site inspection agency he led. Sounds important, but maybe not something most people have heard of.
Probably not. But it was crucial. They were the ones who actually did the work of making sure arms control treaties were being followed. It's one thing to sign a treaty.
It's another to check up on it.
Precisely. Parker's agency handled the on-the-ground checks for all sorts of agreements, conventional forces in Europe, nuclear ICBMs, the INF Treaty for intermediate missiles, chemical weapons, even the Open Skies Treaty allowing surveillance flights.
So they were the referees, basically, making sure nobody was cheating. What happened if they found something suspicious?
Their job was verification, yeah. If they found something that looked like a violation, they'd report it up the chain. Ultimately, it would go to the political leadership, the president, to decide what to do.
Did that happen often?
Parker mentioned that, thankfully, while he was there, they never had a situation escalate quite that far. No major showdowns triggered by an inspection finding, anyway.
He also made an interesting point about the early treaties focusing on the missiles, the delivery systems, not necessarily the warheads themselves. Why start there?
That's a good question. It seemed the thinking was, well, you limit the number of things that can deliver a nuclear weapon, you limit the scale of a potential first strike.
Okay, it makes sense.
The warhead part, the reentry vehicle, or RV, that's obviously key. But maybe controlling the big rockets carrying them was seen as a more achievable first step. You could count silos, count missiles more easily, perhaps. It's that step-by-step approach you see in complex talks, kind of like we discussed in episode 30 with global agreements.
Gotcha. Okay, let's switch gears a bit to the tech. The Minuteman missile. Parker uses it as the main example. Can you break down how one of these things actually works, simply?
Sure. Think of it like a three-part rocket. You've got the first stage, the big booster at the bottom, gives it that initial massive push off the ground.
Okay.
Then there's a connector piece, an interstage, then the second stage fires, pushing it higher and faster, then a third stage. And right at the very top, that's where the reentry system, the RV with the warhead, sits. He also mentioned a spacer, like a gap between stages.
And the fuel was key, right? And solid fuel.
Yes. Solid state boosters, that was a huge deal. Before that, many big rockets used liquid fuel.
Which is unstable. It takes time to load.
Exactly. Less stable, and you had to fuel them up right before launch, which took time, minutes potentially. The Minuteman solid fuel was more like a prepackaged firework. Incredibly powerful. Ready to go almost instantly.
How instantly are we talking?
About 30 seconds from the command to lift off. Compared to, several minutes for some older liquid systems. Big difference if you're worried about incoming missiles. Plus, solid fuel is easier to store reliably for long periods in those underground silos.
And once it's launched, the speed is just mind-boggling. Under 30 minutes to Russia.
Yeah, roughly. Traveling at something like 17,000 miles per hour, it gives you a sense of the reaction times involved. Or lack thereof. Terrifyingly fast.
Okay, so you have these incredibly fast, powerful weapons, but it still comes down to people making the decision to launch. How does that work? What stops someone just doing it?
Right, the human controls. This is where it gets really critical. The launch control centers, they're buried deep underground, like 40, sometimes 90 feet down.
Safe from attack, presumably.
And they're spread out geographically.
Okay.
But the main thing is no single crew in one center can launch alone.
Ah, the Q-key system you hear about.
Kind of, but more complex. It requires at least two different launch control centers. Out of the five, potentially linked to a missile flight, to receive the order, and both turn their keys simultaneously.
So you need cooperation between separate bunkers?
Yes. At a minimum, you need two officers in one center and two officers in another center, so at least four people, all turning keys at the same time based on a valid order. It's built in redundancy and verification.
That's a serious safeguard. But still, the people holding those keys, Parker mentioned they're often really young.
Shockingly young. Sometimes.
Yeah.
Early to mid-20s, he said. Think about that. 22, 23 years old, responsible for potentially launching multiple nuclear missiles.
That is almost impossible to comprehend. The weight on their shoulders. How do they prepare someone for that, psychologically?
Through incredibly intense training, constant drills, rigorous psychological screening, ongoing evaluations. It's a huge focus. There's this built-in tension, isn't there? You have to train them to be ready, willing, and able to turn those keys if the order comes.
But also to understand the absolute gravity and that the order only comes in the most extreme situation from the president if the U.S. is under attack.
Exactly. It requires this profound sense of duty and absolute trust in the chain of command. They have to believe the order is legitimate and necessary if it ever arrives.
Parker called the ICBM system maybe the greatest weapon ever used, which sounds odd given they haven't been fired in anger. What's the thinking there?
It's that idea of deterrence again. He argues its greatest use has been its constant, unwavering readiness. It was always being used, because it was always on alert, 247.
Preventing war just by existing.
That's the idea. He mentioned this grim sort of dark humor phrase among the missile crews. If the other side ever thought about attacking, the thought would be, Minuteman's on alert. Not today, Conrad. That constant vigilance since 1962, that is its function. A source of pride, in a strange way, for those involved.
The weapon you hope you never use is the one that's working perfectly, in a sense.
You could put it that way. It's a heavy concept.
What's it like day to day for those missileers living with that? He mentioned their routine.
Yeah, he shared this one detail.
Yeah.
Every morning, before going underground for their alert duty, maybe at Minot, they'd listen to the local weather forecast. Normal stuff.
Right.
And then they'd listen to the official date and time check. And Parker said, especially after 9/11, that simple time check became this daily reminder that any ordinary day could suddenly become the day everything changes.
Wow. A constant low-level awareness.
And just the humbling feeling, he said, of being given that level of trust, that responsibility at such a young age, he felt the Air Force placed incredible faith in them.
But if that day came, if the order was real...
The mindset, as Parker described it from talking to missileers, wasn't about hesitation. If the authenticated order came from the president to turn keys, the training, the duty, it kicks in. You act. Protect the country. That's the commitment.
Towards the end, Parker brings up Teddy Roosevelt. Seems like a bit of a jump, but there's a connection.
Yeah, he mentioned Roosevelt being a bit of a hero figure growing up in that Upper Plains region, and Roosevelt's whole foreign policy idea.
The big stick thing.
Well, first Parker mentioned Roosevelt's quote about needing intelligent forethought and decisive action sufficiently far in advance of any likely crisis, which, you know, kind of describes the whole point of maintaining a ready deterrent force.
Planning ahead to prevent the crisis.
Exactly. And then there's the more famous version that African proverb Roosevelt adopted. Walk softly, but carry a big stick.
Which fits deterrence perfectly.
It really does. Don't go looking for trouble. Be diplomatic. Walk softly. But make sure potential adversaries know you have overwhelming capability, the big stick, if things go wrong. The ICBM force was and is a very big stick.
It's still kind of staggering to think about this whole hidden world, these bunkers, the power they hold, and these often very young people holding the keys.
And that's really the core takeaway, isn't it? Nuclear deterrence isn't just charts and strategies and technology. Fundamentally, it comes down to people. Their decisions, their training, their dedication. It's a human system through and through.
So as we wrap this up, maybe something for you, the listener, to think about. How relevant is all this today, the system, the human element in our world now?
Does that walk softly but carry a big stick idea still apply in the same way? What are the modern challenges to that kind of deterrence?
Yeah, what does the big stick even look like now, and how softly can anyone walk in today's world? Definitely something to chew on.